Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for Friday, March 15th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Jim Hoffman, and my name is Rachel Thorson Mithelman. And here is Jim with our first story.
Thank you, Rachel, and we'll start off with an article regarding the John Deere Classic. John Deere Classic announces concerts. Lainey Wilson, Counting Crows, to perform. This written by Tom Johnston of the Quads, who writes from QuadCityOnline.com. With an incredibly successful debut of the Concerts on the Course series at last summer's John Deere Classic tournament, officials knew they had a winning formula. On Thursday, John Deere Classic officials announced the two acts that will take the stage during this year's PGA Tour event at the Golf Classic Deer Run. The rock group Counting Crows will perform on Saturday, July 6th, and Grammy Award-winning country music superstar Lainey Wilson is scheduled for Sunday, July 7th. The John Deere Classic is more than thrilled to welcome CMA Entertainer of the Year Lainey Wilson and one of the music industry's top live bands, Counting Crows, to perform at this year's tournament, tournament director Andrew Lehman said. It is going to be a weekend of great golf, great music, and great fun for our fans. These two artists are following last year's artists Darius Rucker and Blake Shelton, who drew huge crowds to the golf course for the initial concerts. With the success of those two performances last year, Deere and Company officials were more than excited to continue incorporating music into the list of tournament week activities. Building off the momentum of last year's John Deere Classic that brought record crowds to Deer Run for an engaging blend of live music and golf, we are excited to announce another powerful concert lineup, said Mara Downing, Vice President, Global Brand and Communications, in a release that went out Thursday. When we renewed our contract with the PGA Tour, we wanted to evolve to attract new and traditional fans to this world-class event. Wilson, who recently won her first Grammy for her critically acclaimed record, Bell Bottom Country, was also honored as Country Music Association's Entertainer of the Year. Counting Crows burst onto the scene in 1993 and is known as one of the preeminent live touring rock bands. Their multi-platinum breakout album, August and Everything After, was the first of seven studio albums that have sold more than 20 million records for the Grammy and Academy Award-nominated group. Both artists are on tour this year and are fitting in the Quad City stops in their schedules. Santana and Counting Crows have a large show scheduled in Tinley Park on Saturday, June 29th, ahead of the John Deere Classic appearance. Their next show is July 18th in Bethel, New York. Wilson has a similar schedule, performing in Bangor, Maine, on June 29th, after a July 12th date in Fort Loramie, Ohio. She is scheduled to be at the Great Jones County Fair in Monticello, Iowa, on July 18th. The John Deere Classic performances are scheduled to take place along the 18th fairway at approximately 5:45 p.m., a short time after golf concludes. Lehman said that the setup will be the same as last year, with fans seated on the hillside to the golfer's right of the fairway across from the stage. There are no separate tickets required for the concerts. A ticket to the golf tournament gets you access to both the tournament and the weekend concert. Tickets for the John Deere Classic go on sale on Wednesday, April 3rd at johndeereclassic.com.
Next article on the front page, Augie hosts re-entry simulation. Students learn about post-prison difficulties. This is written by Olivia Allen of the Quad City Times. Excuse me. Augustana College's prison education program hosted a re-entry simulation to raise awareness about the challenges people often face when transitioning back into their communities after incarceration. Augie students, community members, and nearly 30 volunteers participated in the simulation led by Jeff Abramowitz, Executive Director of the Petey Green Foundation, sponsor of the event. The prison education program is a full-time bachelor's program taught by Augustana College professors at East Moline Correctional Center. Participants were issued a fictional identity and rotated through sessions based on real-life situations. In these sessions, participants had to decide how to get back on track while avoiding instances that could send them back to prison. Carter Wegener, a freshman pre-med major from Wyonette in Bureau County, called the event eye-opening. "The fight doesn't end once you're out of prison. It keeps going," he said. "You're under these timelines and requirements, and if you don't make them, you could face going back to prison. There's so much more to re-entry than everyone else sees." Another freshman pre-vet major, Melissa Cook of Peoria, had a similar experience. She too was surprised at how difficult re-entry can be, noting she also faced rude, discriminatory behavior as part of the simulation. "I was told I couldn't use the bank, and I had to wait 5 minutes to talk to somebody because I allegedly interrupted her conversation," Cook said. "I mean, it was amazing getting to hear all the firsthand stories as well." Based in Princeton, New Jersey, the Petey Green Foundation supports the academic achievement of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people with college readiness programs, tutoring, and advocacy. After the simulations, Abramowitz led a presentation where he and others shared their journeys during and after incarceration. T.Y. Stone, who participated in the prison education program while incarcerated and is now an Augie student, described re-entry as a cloud that hangs over you. "You do the crime, you have to do the time, right? Let's just get that out of the way. Prison is not fun for a reason," he said. "We're not asking you to solve mass incarceration or anything like that, but if you do have it in you, take time to do some research, watch educational videos, or ask people, 'How can I help?' You guys are the young people that can help change discriminatory laws. Policies restricting the social and economic mobility of formerly incarcerated people," Stone said, "are often formed by those with little experience or knowledge on the links between crime and poverty, family loss or trauma, race, and other circumstantial factors. It is important for young people to interact with people outside their cultures, including with formerly incarcerated people," Stone said. During his 5 years in federal prison, Abramowitz missed his daughter's high school graduation. After returning home, he and his daughter recreated her ceremony. She wore her cap and gown, marched across her high school football field, and took pictures. Then the father-daughter duo had a talk. "We sat at the 50-yard line, and I shared my journey from the 5 years I was away. And his daughter did the same," Abramowitz said. "I want everyone to know that we can't turn the hands of our clocks back. We can't take away things we've done and decisions we've made. But that doesn't mean that we can't learn from them. We can make ourselves better because of them." One simulation participant, Rock Island resident Demetrius Williams, also told some of his story. He spent 10 years in prison, a timeline, he said, which started with being convicted for carrying brass knuckles in his pocket at age 16. I've been out since 2014, Williams said, calling the simulation stations very realistic. I'm 58 years old today, and the first thing that pops up when police read my license plates is armed and dangerous. I have never had a firearm. In those 10 years, I suffered the most significant personal losses you can imagine, he added. They don't let you come home from prison when your mother passes away. You don't get a pass for that. You just got to stay in your cell and cry. Legislators don't understand that. The police department doesn't understand that. Abramowitz shared some ways community members can help support prison education and reentry, such as volunteering with related social programs, donating to related funds, legislative advocacy, and staying informed. But there's something even simpler than that, he said. Let's start bringing the humanity back into our systems. To both Wagner and Cook, that theme was a big takeaway from Wednesday. If somebody has been in prison, that doesn't instantly mean they're a bad person. You just have no clue what situation they're in, Wagner said. People have things going on in their lives that they can't control, so I think we need to be respectful and mindful of that. Everyone deserves respect. Cook said she feels more empowered to do something about the prison system and help those seeking reentry. She plans to start helping with fundraising. Asked how prison changed him the most, Abramowitz said he now takes responsibility for everything. Everything, he emphasized. If I walk past a homeless person, it is my responsibility to say hello and ask to help them get what they need. And it's not about money. It's more about recognizing that they are there. For those seeking to rebuild their lives after incarceration, Abramowitz said, the little things, like a smile, handshake, or brief greeting, often matter the most. In closing, he urged Wednesday's participants to do at least one good deed each day. Williams echoed this, recalling his own experience. Something I learned from 10 years in prison, he said, be a little kinder.
Thanks, Rachel. Blake keeps same attorney in murder case. This written by Tom Lowy and Anthony Watt of the Quad City Times. After complaining about her representation in a letter written in the Scott County Jail, Adriana Blake has elected to keep her attorney. Blake faces numerous charges, including two counts of first-degree murder in the January 15th slaying of Brian L. Goodwin and Amy M. Smith. She wrote to District 7 Associate Judge Michael Motto on February 25th asking for a new attorney. Blake, 27, of Davenport, is represented by Troy Smith of the State Public Defender's Office. Blake wrote that Smith had not met with her to discuss her case when he said he would. She wanted someone who had time for her case and would listen to her wishes. At a hearing Thursday before District Court Judge Stuart P. Werling, Smith questioned Blake about changing counsel, saying that he thought it was necessary to confirm whether she wanted another attorney representing her. I do not want new counsel, Blake said during that questioning. Blake told the court she'd spoken with Smith and Leanne Striegel, another assistant public defender, and was satisfied with them. Smith said Blake had also mentioned having mental health issues while at the jail. At the hearing, Smith asked her whether those issues were having any effect on her ability to make her decision about counsel. Blake said they were not. Blake has a co-defendant, Devin Brait, 34, of Davenport, in relation to the slayings of Goodwin and Smith. As of Thursday, Blake and Brait both faced two counts each of first-degree murder. They each also face charges of 2 counts of first-degree robbery, 2 counts of assault while participating in a felony, serious injury, 2 counts of going armed with intent, 2 counts of use of dangerous weapon in commission of a crime, 2 counts of abuse of a corpse, 1 count of first-degree arson, 1 count of dominions, control of firearm, offensive weapon by felon, 1 count of possession of controlled substance. In Blake's case, the allegation was it was her second offense. For Brait, it was listed as his third or subsequent offense. Blake and Brait were arrested for being felons in possession of firearms on January 18th and were officially charged with the murders on February 7th. They appeared in court as co-defendants on February 16th. Blake was represented by public defender Troy Smith. Brait was represented by Amy Keeps of the Des Moines-based Special Defense Unit. In the pair's murder case, District Court Judge Stuart P. Werling is assigned as the trial judge who will oversee the proceedings, according to court documents. The appointment documents were filed on March 5th. Investigators say Blake and Brait possessed firearms during the commission of the crimes. Arresting officers said that even when Blake and Brait were taken into custody on January 18th, they had 4.3 grams of heroin and 11 grams of meth. In the letter written on February 25th, Blake asked Motto for a different attorney and named private attorneys Andrea Jaeger and Eric, for whom she does not give a last name. The second could be Jaeger's partner, Eric Tindall, at the law firm Keegan, Tindall, and Jaeger. Blake claims she was not being adequately represented by Smith. Troy Smith also told me when I had court on the 16th that he would be here last week to speak with me, and he never came, Blake wrote in the letter. When Blake was originally arrested on January 18th, she was booked under the name Adriana Prieto. In the letter, Blake asked for all her documentation to show her last name as Blake. She said she was married on July 4th, 2023, and has identification showing her married name. Her newest letter to Motto, dated March 10th, is 3.5 pages long and alleges Scott County Jail medical staff and corrections officers are ignoring her requests for assistance. Blake claims in the letter she has been denied access to medical and mental health services, as well as the use of a toothbrush and toothpaste. Blake also made a number of complaints in the newest letter about her state of mind. She describes periods of feeling delirious. Later in the letter, Blake claims she spent some of her time in the jail hallucinating. She said she thought she saw her dead husband and traveled through time. While claiming she is terrified at the prospect of being housed in this jail, Blake did not ask to be moved to another facility. The bodies of the Goodwin and Smith, both 44, were found January 16th by Davenport firefighters after a fire was reported at Goodwin's residence at 5210 North Division Street. They had gunshot wounds. According to their arrest affidavits, Blake and Brait also lived. First-degree murder carries an automatic sentence of life in prison upon conviction. During the February 16th court hearing, Davenport police investigator Brandon Askew testified that Blake was recorded on video in a hotel room in Galesburg, Illinois, bragging about killing 2 people. Askew also testified that Blake and Brait were in possession of the firearms believed to be used in the murders when they were arrested on January 18th. According to the arrest affidavits, Blake and Brait killed Goodwin and Smith between 4:30 and 7 a.m. on, excuse me, I need to get to the next page, Monday, January 15th. Another woman also was arrested February 7th in connection with the case. Melissa Marie Weber, 49, is charged with two counts of abuse of a corpse and one count each of accessory after the fact and second-degree arson. Blake and Brayett, along with Weber, placed combustible materials inside the residence where the bodies of Goodwin and Smith were located, authorities allege. They set fire to the materials in the hopes of altering the crime scene. The fire damaged the bodies of Goodwin and Smith. After helping to start the fire, Weber helped Blake and Brayett avoid apprehension, the affidavit said. Weber is being held in the Rock Island County Jail for Scott County. So what's next? Blake, Brayett, and Weber had arraignments scheduled for later Thursday morning. At arraignments, the court informs defendants of the charges filed against them by the state, according to the Iowa Judicial Branch website. Defendants can choose not to appear in court for arraignments. They can instead file documents acknowledging the charges. Those filings include entering a plea of not guilty. Brayett and Weber filed written arraignments rather than appear Thursday. Blake was also expected to file a written arraignment, but it had not yet appeared in her case record Thursday afternoon.
The final story on the front page of the Quad City Times comes from Davenport. Council tables exec order vote. Aldermen hold off ratifying agreements. This is written by Sarah Watson of the Quad City Times. Davenport council members voted unanimously on Wednesday to delay votes on ratifying the mayor's appointments of the interim city administrator and interim city attorney. Dozens of Davenport residents turned out to tell the council to vote down the items on the agenda. Residents expressed concern with how more decisions were being voted on by the council months later, calling the agreements backroom deals and questioning the credentials of the two staffers. The goal is basically for the 10 council people to have input on what to do, what our next step needs to be, and what we just feel that we need to have the time to discuss it, 8th Ward Alderperson Paul Reinarts Jr. said in explaining the reasoning to a reporter on the motion to table the two discussion items. The council items were tabled for two cycles and are expected to return to the agenda in April. The two items would ratify Mayor Mike Mattson's appointments of Mallory Merritt as interim city administrator and Brian Heyer as interim city attorney. They also include pay and expectations for the positions. Mattson signed an executive agreement November 8th to appoint Merritt as interim city administrator starting November 17th, 2023. In addition to Merritt's duties as assistant city administrator and chief financial officer, November 17th was also former city administrator Corey Spiegel's last day working in office. The city also entered into a memorandum of understanding on November 8th, formalizing Merritt's appointment and setting expectations and pay. Merritt's base salary of $174,420 was kept the same, but under the agreement, she would receive a lump sum $50,000 bonus on the May 3rd payroll cycle for the extra duties. The memorandum was signed by Mattson and the five aldermen that chaired committees at the time, but the memorandum did not come before council in a meeting for a public vote. Now, according to the city council background documents, the city's outside legal counsel advises that the city council should ratify the executive orders and Merritt's memorandum of understanding and approve a negotiated amendment with additional pay for Merritt and negotiated agreement with Heyer. This is my take on it, said Judith Lee, who represented 8th Ward on the council until the start of the year, leaving after losing a re-election bid. That what the mayor, the interim city administrator, the legal department via their review of the memorandums of understanding, and Lane and Waterman are expecting you to do tonight is to provide public cover for a secret action hidden from the public and half of the council that the mayor took 4 months ago. When Merritt's predecessor, Spiegel, was appointed interim city administrator in June of 2015, it came before the council for a vote. Mattson did not attend Wednesday night's regular meeting nor last week's committee of the whole meeting and did not return a call from a reporter. At-large alderperson Kyle Gripp, who tuned into the meeting remotely, said he and the mayor were in Washington, D.C. meeting with federal officials about city projects and priorities. Others were quick to notice the mayor's absence as the ratifications appeared on the agenda. The agenda item up for consideration also included a more recently negotiated amendment that would adjust Merritt's salary to be increased 2.5% retroactively to January 7th. The amendment also agrees that Merritt will serve as interim city administrator until the city appoints someone to the position permanently. If she serves beyond April 30th as interim, the agreement states that Merritt would be paid an additional $5,000 a month. The agreement would last until November 17th, and if a permanent city administrator isn't appointed by then, Merritt and the city would negotiate a revised agreement. Merritt's appointment came after Spiegel reached a separation agreement with the city that included $1.6 million in payment for lost wages and emotional pain and suffering because of alleged harassment by elected officials. The agreement with Spiegel, signed October 6th, stipulated that Spiegel's employment with the city would end January 2, 2024, and she would be on paid leave from November 17th until January 2nd. Her departure and settlement was not announced until after the November elections. The council did not vote on Spiegel's agreement in a public meeting either until 3 months after it was signed. The city council ratified it in December, also on the advice of outside counsel. Mattson, via executive order, also appointed Heyer as the interim city attorney January 2nd. Also included in the council's item would be approval of Memorandum of Understanding for Heyer, dated March 13th, which would keep Heyer's salary at $123,708 and provides a lump sum bonus of $50,000 on the May 3rd payroll cycle. Heyer was appointed after previous longtime city attorney Tom Warner stopped doing work for the city in December and officially retired at the start of the new year. Davenport Civil Rights Director Latrice Lacey and another employee of the department told the City Council they would be amending existing or filing new equal pay complaints with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission if the Council approves the bonuses for Merritt and Heyer. Lacey said she works multiple jobs, and her staffers routinely work 60 to 80 hours a week, yet she said her budget requests for additional dollars and staff are typically denied. She said, "We ask for additional funding every year. We're told it's not in the budget, so somehow we have $50,000 that we can give out. This is a waste of money. It's a slap in the face, and it's discriminatory." Ezra Sidran, a frequent commenter at Davenport meetings and records requester, questioned Merritt's credentials, pointing to a court transcript in which Merritt says her first job in her career field was at the City of Davenport. He and others also questioned the quality of legal advice the City Council received under the former city attorney and Heyer, pointing to the city's use of outside attorneys to review previous legal advice and referencing the city's records court case in which Sidran is named as a defendant. Some public commenters said they thought it was unprofessional of Heyer to decline to publicly answer a legal question from at-large alderperson Jasmine Newton during a recent meeting. Some council members took particular issue with members of the public, alleging that Merritt was unqualified. Grip called Merritt uniquely qualified to lead the city staff until a permanent successor is chosen, and said if she were to look outside the city of Davenport for employment, she would be a top candidate for a municipal leadership position. Merritt has been the city's chief financial officer and one of two assistant city administrators since June of 2020. Previously, she's worked for the city as its human resources director, assistant to the city administrator, and budget management analyst 1 and 2. She has a master's of public administration from Auburn University. Sixth Ward alderperson Ben Jobgen said he's received more communications from Merritt in the past few months than he had previously, and it's not unusual for someone to be promoted within the same organization, pointing to his own experience being promoted to a director in his field within 6 years of graduating physical therapy school and landing his first job. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no long obituaries in today's paper, but there are several death notices, if as I turn the page here I can find them. I'll read the first few, Jim, if you'll take the kind of the last half. The first is Dorothy I. Wetzel, age 88, of Muscatine, died Wednesday, March 13th at home. Cremation will be directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. Constance K. Davis, age 81, of Rock Island, died Wednesday, March 13th at Generations at Rock Island. Cremation will be directed by Cremation Society of the Quad Cities. John Daler, age 73, of Monmouth, Iowa, passed away on Tuesday, March 12th at Genesis Medical Center in Davenport. Arrangements are pending at Carson Celebrations of Life Center in Maquoketa. Arlene Salinas, age 72, of Galesburg, Illinois, passed away Tuesday, March 5th at her home. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline. And Laura Lee Martzluff, age 66, of Rock Island, passed away Wednesday, March 13th at Genesis Medical Center, East Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial of Moline.
And we also have Anna Elizabeth Dunham Sparkman, passed away on Thursday, March 14th at Silver Cross Nursing Center at Friendship Manor, Rock Island, Illinois. Arrangements are pending at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island. Franklin Frank Carroll, 81, of Moline, passed away Friday, March 8th. At his home, cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and direct burial, Moline. Greta W. Nordstrom, 90, of Geneseo, passed away on Wednesday, March 13th at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Arrangements are pending at Vandemore Funeral Homes and Crematory in Geneseo Chapel. Susan J. Olson, 69, of Moline, passed away March 12th at the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City. Arrangements are pending at Esther Dahl Mortuary and Crematory Limited in Moline. Dorothy A. Cole, 94, of Princeton, died on Thursday, March 14th at Jersey Ridge Place in Davenport. Arrangements are pending at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home in Bettendorf. And finally, Mark William Mangan, 67, of Clinton, passed away Wednesday, March 13th at Eagle Point Nursing and Rehabilitation Center, Clinton. Arrangements are pending at Snellzorig in Clinton.
We turn now to the opinion page of the Quad City Times. There's an editorial and some letters to the editor, and also a guest editorial. So the first comes from Tom Martin, the editor of the Quad City Times. Beginning today, the Quad City Times and Dispatch Argus will require letters to the editor be emailed to the newsroom rather than mailed. We want to aim our staff at producing local content, stories, photos, videos, and have decided to no longer key in hard copy letters. I realize accepting letters via mail is a long-standing tradition, but we believe most of our readers now have access to email. Being able to copy and paste letters will save us time for more reporting. Email your letters to opinions@qctimes.com for the Quad City Times and letters@qconline.com for the Dispatch Argus. Please refrain from mailing us letters to the editor. We had a letter recently accusing us of handling conservative letters differently than liberal ones. I realize that I will never completely quell the belief that we favor writers of one political stripe over another, but we don't. In this case, the accusation was that we delay letters that don't match our biased agenda. Our agenda is to provide local news. That takes up most of our energy, but we do want to allow readers to express their opinions. Some time ago, the Quad City Times and Dispatch Argus decided to implement a 30-day letter policy. That is, a writer can submit a letter every 30 days. Even with this rule, we have a lot of letters, often from the same writers. Sometimes it takes a week or longer to get them published after they are submitted. We never decide which letters to run or when they will be published based on political stance. Never. A letter could be delayed because there are too many letters, or sometimes a letter doesn't fit the print space, but runs more quickly online because space is not a factor. Sometimes a letter presents a fact that is clearly not true. I try to work with authors on these, asking for some documentation or legitimate sources for verification. Sometimes we make a mistake. We overlooked a letter, or maybe it didn't make the page and we neglected to move it to the next publication day. It has happened, and I apologize for that. I try to be as fair as I can with handling letters to the editor. As our photographers, Caitlin Metzger and Roy Dabner, are on a conquest to create collections of images, I'll share those with you in this column. For a second straight week, the top photo gallery is connected to the Iowa Hawkeyes. Most page views of the photos, Hawkeyes' Cape Martin signs autograph at Zimmerman Honda in Moline. But here are some of the photo galleries you might have missed. Hands-on Trades Expo introduces students to the trades. Popular Astronomy visits John Deere Middle School. Thursday coverage of the 2024 MVC Women's Basketball Tournament. Spring Floral Show at Vanderveer Conservatory. Build Like a Deer, Bush Construction's fourth annual, Build Like a Girl, Bush Construction's fourth annual workshop. And Davenport Assumption claims 3A boys state basketball title. If you have a good idea for a photo gallery or story, email us at newsroom@qctimes.com or press@qconline.com. And here are the most viewed stories of the past 7 days. From the Quad City Times, number one, bicyclist killed when hit by pickup Tuesday in Davenport. The second most viewed story, 15-year-old charged with murder in Davenport shooting of 16-year-old girl. And the third most viewed story, timeless tickets, Eric Clapton closes Davenport's rockin' summer of 74 with record-setting show. And from the Dispatch Argus, those most viewed stories are bicyclist killed when hit by pickup truck in Davenport, 15-year-old charged with murder in Davenport shooting of 16-year-old girl, and the last one, Glenn J. Evans Jr., found guilty of first-degree murder for 2023 shooting in Rock Island.
And also here on the opinion page, Mayor Mattson must answer to public or step down. This written by Dr. Alan Dirks. He is a property owner in Davenport and Bettendorf. And an editor's note on this, in January, Alan Dirks filed a lawsuit against the Davenport City Council. Former city attorney Thomas Warner and the city of Davenport claiming they executing agreements with city officials without prior city council approval. Who does Davenport Mayor Mike Mattson serve? Certainly not the citizens and taxpayers of Davenport, with his actions taken in the past 6 months regarding large monetary payments to three former city employees. Davenport's almost $2 million in payments to three top city employees, including the highest paid employee, City Administrator Corin Spiegel, amounts to more money than the city spends on many city projects in 1 year. Mattson has condoned and encouraged the behavior of the former city attorney's efforts to keep these settlements from the public eye. Why were these extraordinarily large three monetary settlements kept secret until after the November 7, 2023 mayoral election? Could it be that it was because Mattson was in a contentious re-election bid for votes on November 7, 2023 with Iowa State Representative Ken Croken, and might well have lost the mayoral election had full disclosure been made to the public? Transparency was supposed to be the hallmark of Mattson's re-election bid. Mattson's recent actions as mayor reflect a clear lack of transparency. In fact, Mattson is now allowing an outside law firm hired by the city to sue a local resident who requested the demand letter of former city administrator Corin Spiegel that precipitated her settlement and the $1 million payout to her. Mattson is also condoning the city's attempt to block Iowa State Auditor Rob Sands' state audit of the Davenport books regarding these high-priced settlements. Was Mattson afraid the public would look with disdain on him if the public actually read the Spiegel demand letter netting her $1.6 million of taxpayer dollars, including payment to Spiegel of $1 million, tax-free, for alleged emotional distress? Mattson was in favor of these large payouts by the city and has never publicly even questioned whether or not they should have been paid. Apparently, the city has millions of dollars to pay out to former city employees, but will not try to settle the lawsuits with the 80 tenants who either died, were permanently maimed for life, or were similarly displaced from their residences at 324 Main Street on May 28, 2023. This infamous building collapse occurred a few hundred feet from City Hall, and in full view of Mattson's third-floor mayoral office window. Spiegel is the named individual defendant in two of these building lawsuits. Why would the city voluntarily pay Spiegel $1.6 million without her first filing a lawsuit or even making an EEOC complaint against the city alleging a factual basis for her claim? Presently, the public knows nothing about Spiegel's factual allegation except tidbits of information transmitted to the public by the city alleging harassment. The city refuses to disclose Spiegel's demand letter. Instead, the city sues a local citizen, Ezra Sidran, who requested the demand letter pursuant to the Iowa Public Records Act. Why didn't the city let a judge and jury determine whether or not Spiegel had any viable legal claims against the city? Litigation would have provided answers to these allegations that the public would understand. Why did a subordinate of Spiegel's at City Hall sign her settlement agreement without prior city council approval? These questions demand answers by Mattson to the public. Mattson has refused or has defected and failed to provide the public with clear factual answers over the past 6 months. Mattson owes the public that much as their mayor. This has the appearance of a cover-up by Mattson and has an odor to it. Mattson must come clean with the citizens of Davenport. He must promptly release the September 25, 2023 Spiegel demand letter and direct the dismissal of the city's lawsuit against Sidran. The mayor must further spell out to the public the rationale for these historically large payments. The city deserves nothing less. I cannot, and many of my public citizens colleagues also cannot, accept the way the entire sordid matter has been handled. Mattson must answer to the public or step down as mayor.
Thank you, Jim. There are 4 letters to the editor in today's paper, and I just wanted to read 2 of them. First, alderpersons should follow their own paths. Alderpersons. What is an alderperson? A person being elected to serve the citizens of a specific part of a town is a good start, and to work with the other alderpersons to improve the town as a whole and direct staff to facilitate this endeavor. Your job is to help the citizens in your ward navigate the endless stream of administrative overreach and draconian threats from staff. There is nothing more heartbreaking than an 80-year-old lady in poor health calling you, terrified from a letter she received from the city saying she has 2 weeks to comply or face fines. Nothing is more satisfying than to see her smile of relief when you tell her not to worry, it's been taken care of. You must be available to the people of your ward. Be willing to help people in other wards. Keep the local alderperson informed. Got to love business, but most business owners don't live in your ward, so keep that relationship in perspective. All business is not good. Congrats to all the new alderpersons. Don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't let the at-large, mayor, or alderpersons with more experience intimidate or talk down to you. You are all equal. No alderperson is more powerful than the other. The key part is that you are in control. You wouldn't know it by the way this council runs, but yes, alderpersons, you are in charge. Don't let the mayor and staff lead you down their path. Follow your own. That letter submitted by Derek O. Cornett of Davenport. And then the other one I wanted to read relates to the editorial from today's paper. In March 10th's Letters to the Editor page, Luanne Beinke called out what she thinks is a liberal bias in the Dispatch's policy of a 30-day waiting period between submitting letters. She concludes by saying, "I was considering voting Democrat, but reading this page made me decide to vote Republican or Independent. May I suggest that if you predicate your voting decisions on your perception of bias in a local newspaper, you really need a much better rationale for voting. I mean, how can someone at this point be so completely ambivalent about the voting options that they hinge something so important as a vote on whether or not a full 30 days has elapsed between opinion letters from readers, especially since media bias is on full display for both the left and the right? Do you tally up how many liberal sources there are and compare them to conservative sources and base a decision on that? It seems irresponsible to me." That's submitted by Christopher Snurka of Moline.
Thank you, Rachel. Turning to the sports, Bofelli earns latest MVC honor. UNI standout overcame broken collarbone. This written by Tom Johnston of who writes in online. Earning first team All-Missouri Valley Conference honors isn't anything new for Grace Bofelli. The University of Northern Iowa junior was a first team selection last season after being honorable mention the season before. Her stellar play even earned her the 2023-24 preseason Player of the Year honor last fall. But this one was different for her when she found out Wednesday evening she had earned first-team All-MVC honors again. The North Scott High School All-Stater had to recover from a broken collarbone that kept her sidelined for 8 weeks. I think that through the season, with me being out 6 to 8 weeks with my shoulder and I had to work hard, said Bofelli on Friday afternoon at Vibrant Arena at the Mark as she and her team watched first-round hoops in the Heartland action, it's been hard coming back from injury. But since we're here, I'm really proud of myself. Her coach, Tanya Warren, is as well. Seeing what her 6'1 junior forward did after the injury has been nothing short of incredible. She is averaging 15.3 points, 8.9 rebounds per game, while recording 10 double-doubles this season. That, said Warren, has made this honor for Bofelli more special than others. It was, for a variety of reasons, said Warren. First off, the league is deeper than it's ever been. When you talk about missing 3 conference games, not many people can miss 6 weeks and come back and do what she's done in league play. For Bofelli, it was a learning experience. It was the first major injury that she's endured in her storied career, which included leading her North Scott Lancers to 3 state class 4A titles. The injury left her in a sling for 6 weeks, and then dedicated rehab that she said included physical therapy with a trainer twice a day. Instead of letting the setback get her down, she said she just tried to make the most of it. I wasn't used to it at all. I had never really gone through an injury in high school, and this was really the first time I've been injured. It's important that I was positive every day with my injury. I believed in my coaches and what they were saying to me. I think I gained a new perspective when I was on the sideline coaching my teammates. During timeouts, I would be the first person to coach them. I gained a new perspective being a leader. I'm just thankful that I'm back. Warren loved seeing her stand out, excel in a different way. You see the game through a different pair of lenses when you have to sit out, said Warren. What I loved about her was that she is right there in the huddle. When we were meeting as coaches, she was in the huddle and took my seat and was talking to them about what she saw. That's the kind of leadership we need. She never missed a day, even when she wasn't playing. She was right in there and they listened. As a captain and leader, they listened to her voice. Bofelli wasted little time making her mark when she did return to the court. In her first game back on January 19th against Valparaiso, she scored 16 points and grabbed 7 rebounds in just 18 minutes. My message to her coming back was, "Grace, you have to give yourself some grace," Warren said. "I think it's human nature when you play at the level she plays at that you want to come back at the level you were playing prior to the injury. Like I said, only she could come back and do what she's been able to do." Warren feels that the honor will free Bofelli to have a different perspective during this Missouri Valley Conference tournament in her own backyard. "I think it will allow her to take a deep breath and literally just play and not feel like she has something to prove," said Warren. "When you get that label early on, it's hard and there's a lot of undue pressure that comes with that. I think there's a sigh of relief." The 15-14 fourth-seeded Panthers open tournament play on Friday at 2:32 p.m. against the fifth-seeded Illinois State Redbirds. The Redbirds advanced by beating number 12, Evansville, 85-64. "I'm super excited for this week," said Bofelli, "of playing at home again. Just to see family and friends back at home and play in front of a big crowd. I'm super excited."
And that Hoops in the Heartland MVC tournament, an article about that Illinois game, Redbirds rolled past Evansville. This by Tom Johnston. Illinois State University women's basketball coach Kristen Gillespie and her team found themselves in a different position on Thursday. As the number 5 seed, they were in first day action of the Missouri Valley Conference tournament. But an earlier debut in the Hoops in the Heartland event at Vibrant Arena at the Mark went swimmingly for the Redbirds as they routed number 12 Evansville 85-64. It's March, and I thought this game played out as well as it possibly could have for us, minus some of the first half turnovers, said Gillespie, after her club moved to 21-10. What I love is that we get a game under our belts, no one played heavy minutes, and we get the nerves out of our system. We have the utmost respect for Robin, Evansville coach Robin Sherwells, and the Evansville program, but today was all about us and what we're trying to do. I love the mentality that this team has. The Redbirds wasted little time in taking control, jumping out to a double-digit lead over the 4-28 Aces just 6 minutes into the contest and never looking back. 11 of ISU's 13 players to see action cracked the scoring column. The Redbirds had 4 players in double-digit scoring, freshman Shannon Dowell with 14 points in 18 minutes, Deanna Wilson with 11 points in just over 11 minutes, Dijah Smith with 11 points in 17 minutes, and Maya Wong with 10 points in 21 minutes of action. Former Central DeWitt High School standout Taylor Veach saw nearly 5 minutes of action for ISU, recording one assist as she missed her only field goal attempt. A tough season for the Aces came to an end, but Sherwells was optimistic as her two top scorers are both freshmen. Neva Thomas led the Aces with a game-high 23, 21 of those in the second half. Maggie Hartwig added 16 points. Both shared team rebounding honors with 5 each. Gillespie is hoping that Thursday's win lays a nice foundation for future success in the Hoops in the Heartland Gathering, beginning with Friday's game against UNI. So that on the MVC Women's Tournament this weekend. And that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. My name is Rachel Mithelman, and my partner at the microphone has been Jim Hoffman. You can listen to IRA's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org.